Hello, and welcome to another episode of eDiscovery Chicks, the podcast about all things eDiscovery and legal tech, hosted by two gals who are feeling very tired and very fulfilled right now after spending a weekend in Chicago together. Anyways, we are your hosts. That's Bree.
And that's Angie. We are. And some of us are a little bit more tired than other people who, I don't know, Angie gets off the plane and goes home and plants a garden. Bree gets off the plane and goes directly to bed.
I did that first. I came home.
Okay. That makes me feel better.
Oh, yeah. I took an hour and a half long nap, and it was one of those things. And that was all the time I had, because that's all the time that my toddler napped for. But I could have kept sleeping for sure.
Oh, I could have kept sleeping too. But, you know, then my family was like, hi, person. We haven't seen you. Oh my goodness. But before we talk some more about our trip, I do want to tell you, coming up ahead, we are going to continue on our EDRM series. Now, this is part 5. We've almost come to the end of the road. No, I won't go boys to men.
No, please always go boys to men. It's always the right answer.
So at this point, we've covered identification, preservation, collection, processing, and review. And so today we're going to be talking about production, but we did want to share with you a bit about our Chicago experience, because it's the first time that the eDiscovery chicks have all gotten together in one place to focus on just us. And it wasn't just me and Angie. It was also Megan Odom, who does our social media for us and helps us with our branding. So it was a lot of fun. And we thought it was hilarious, some of the things that we all have in common, one being that we're all older sisters. So that meaning that we all know what's right and we're always right and we get shit done. Okay, people.
Oh, that meant that we came to Chicago with a fully fleshed out agenda and over fries, Caesar salads, and dirty martinis, got through the entire freaking agenda and came away with action items that That's were clearly right. defined and assigned to each person.
And there may or may not be some spreadsheets involved.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely some spreadsheets. No, it was so great. I mean, I think you could pack for a 4-week Europe vacation in the bags under my eyes, but I feel so fulfilled and grateful to be working with both of you. Like, I love this podcast. I love getting to just shoot the shit with you. I love that we have forged this interstate friendship. I just feel really full and grateful right now.
I feel the same way. I mean, I think it's cool and just a testament to eDiscovery in general. This industry and this experience in my life has brought me so many rewards in the form of people
yes.
who have been a part of it. And you guys are certainly two people that I'm very, very blessed to have in my life. And I found it fun because we talked a lot about why we're doing this, and we're going to share with you guys more as we unveil a website coming up in our near future and share with you guys a little bit more on social media. But it was really great to hear that part. And we don't, you know, we get silly and we joke around a lot on this podcast, but our hearts are truly in what we're doing.
That's one of the things I've loved about eDiscovery as well, is it just feels like this beautiful community of people, and everyone is so accepting and supportive and welcoming. And that has not always been my experience in other areas of the legal profession. And so It makes me really excited to be a part of this world.
Yeah, me too. And I can echo the same sentiment from my own experience. So what was the thing in Chicago that you found the most fun outside of planning and scheming for eDiscovery Chicks' future?
Bree, for her listeners, Bree is very, very good at picking restaurants. And so I thought it was really fun to go and try places that you liked, and then also some new places that you'd found for us. And so we went to Purple Pig in Chicago, which was amazing. And then we went to Daisy's. I love to travel by eating. I love to just eat my way through the world like the hungry caterpillar.
Exactly. I love that.
And so that was so fun for me. And you found places I wouldn't necessarily have found. And you did so much research. And it was just so much fun to experience that with you guys. Well, I love sharing a quality meal with people.
I'm glad you liked them. And also, this is another reason I know that me and Angie are really soulmates, that she wants to be a hungry caterpillar with me, because I want to do the same thing. And I even remember growing up, one of the first food experiences I ever had that was just really meaningful to me was I had a friend whose family had a reunion in Mexico, and they did the whole bury the goat in the yard thing and like cook it overnight in the ground. And they had all this just truly authentic food that I had never had before. And I had never been in a big group of people who, number one, I didn't speak their language, but number two, were just like so open and welcoming and loving and wanted to share who they were as a people. And by tasting their food, you just felt so much love and you got who they were. I mean, I was probably like 8 or 9 when that happened. That was just like an earth-changing moment. I want to go everywhere in the world and eat to understand people and like their hearts, you know? And I've never ever lost that desire.
Oh my God. Okay. Yeah. Well, I could talk about food all day, but should we talk about e-discovery?
Okay.
Well, like we said, today we are talking about production. So production is the process of delivering relevant requested documents or ESI to either other parties in litigation or to regulatory bodies during legal proceedings. Basically, how do you give your stuff to your enemies and other people?
Yeah, that's right. And it's usually the part of the process that a lot of folks don't want to touch with a 10-foot pole because it's scary, because it's final, and it's the final product that will go to the judge or go to the regulating body or whomever needs to have this documentation, and you can't take it back. There's no takesy backsies. Well, I mean, I guess there's a clawback, but we'll talk about that here in a moment, but not really. It's like telling somebody, pretend like I didn't say that, but you did.
I heard it.
And I can't forget it.
You can't unring the bell.
For realsies, though, we are going to be talking about production. And I think it's worth mentioning, but sometimes production seems like the easiest part. If you don't know any better, you're like, oh, what's the big deal? All the hard work's been done already. We've already reviewed all the crap. We had to go vet out who had the data or the documents that were relevant or being asked for. We've had to go through all the steps to figure out, is it privileged? Is it going to be redacted? Is this... All the questions have been answered. So production should be the easiest part, right? No.
Just hit send.
Oh my God. It is the most complicated thing. And the bigger the production, the more complicated it is. In fact, if you go to a service provider, they have entire teams of people that are just dedicated to production because it is so complicated sometimes and it absolutely has to be right. We're going to be talking today about technical considerations, legal and ethical issues, best practices for quality control, negotiating our production protocols, and the challenges of cross-border and data protection.
Oof. Okay. And so we're going to dive into all of that in a second. Let's start with why. Why do we have to produce things? And it's pretty simple. As far as private lawsuits go, the federal rules of civil procedure say we have to. And as far as government investigations go, there's statutory authority. We could talk for days about the various government statutes that require us to produce documents. We could talk for days about the federal rules of civil procedure, but that is not the point of today's episode. And also nobody wants that. So instead, let's talk about how you do this shit. Bree just mentioned something really important, and that is production protocols. And that's actually where we're going to start today, because one of the best things you can do for yourself is negotiate an effective production protocol. And we're using that term loosely. If you're in litigation, it might be something a little bit more formal. If you're working with a government agency or like you've gotten a civil investigative demand or something, it might be a little bit more of a back and forth email conversation. But regardless, it's going to be your roadmap for how you're producing things. Let's talk about how to negotiate one and why the hell they matter.
That's right. And within that production protocol, which you guys have heard us talk about, ESI agreements, discovery orders, we've talked about that all the way throughout this whole series of the EDRM. I mean, they kind of dictate how we do everything along the way, right? So a big thing to consider at this point when we're thinking about, hey, let's negotiate with one another to figure out what protocols we want to follow with production. Let's think about what we can personally do as a company or an entity, what's necessary. What's within the scope of the cost? What are all those thoughts that we need to think about when we're negotiating with those protocols or with one another? And remember, when we talk about production protocols, where they often will include things like format specifications, what searches you were supposed to run on your data in the first place, and the scope of what your production really entails. We might agree to produce everything in a TIFF format, in a PDF format, in a native format for different reasons. That's part of what you agree on in your production protocol. And you want to make sure that what you're agreeing to is something that's actually beneficial for you, your company, and the other considerations I was just mentioning.
100%. Well, one other thing I want to flag is that without a clear agreement on your production protocols, you might end up with compatibility issues. So for example, one party could produce documents in a format that the other party's review platform can't handle efficiently, or vice versa. If you don't protect your own interests, somebody might give you a bunch of garbage. No, well, not garbage, but just data that like you can't ingest into whatever your review platform is. And typically, parties are only required to produce data once. So if you fail to negotiate something that's compatible with the platform you're using, you might sort of be shit out of luck, or else have to spend a bunch of money getting a different platform. That could be a nightmare, and you want to avoid that.
So another thing that you want to make sure that we think about at this point in time in terms of ESI protocols is, what did you guys agree on when it comes to your metadata fields? Now, these are things like, who was the author? What date was this document edited or modified? What date was this email sent? What was the subject of that email? And then you might have other fields like, what was the privileged reason that you marked this privilege and confidential? In that ESI protocol document, it will map out for you and exactly what you are required to produce to one another. And that's important to consider when you're writing the protocol, because you don't want to agree to something that's going to either hang your client or be way too expensive to achieve or impossible to achieve with the tools that you have. But certainly at this point in time, when you're producing documents, you need to make sure that you're fulfilling the expectations of what fields you both have agreed to produce to one another. And those will be produced in a load file, which we will give you the lowdown on later on. The lowdown on the load file.
Oh my God, I love it. Not all metadata fields are created equal. So some are more relevant than others, depending on your situation. Some are going to be useful, some are going to be clutter. So I don't know, Bree, like in your experience, how do people decide what they want and what they want to produce?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of times people choose standard fields. I get asked a lot by clients, and I was asked a lot internally when I was an e-discovery manager at a corporation. What are just the standard fields that we're required to produce that everybody else produces that we can just agree on? I mean, you've got your authors and dates and all those things that are pretty standard. Then you get into some gray areas where opposing counsel finds out, for example, well, all this data came from a homegrown application that contains a field that will give me thoughts on strategy. And I want you to produce that field too. No, I don't think we're going to do that, because maybe that gives you information that's confidential or privileged or outside of the scope of what this legal matter even involves. And that's not pertinent.
Too burdensome.
Right.
When you are negotiating what fields you want and what ones you want to produce, you want to make sure that you're not stripping out anything essential, anything that could make it more or less difficult to assess the authenticity of a document, right? If you strip out things like created date or author, you know, you might end up with just a random bunch of documents and have no idea really where they came from. So you want to make sure you're not being overbroad or under-inclusive.
Right. So I think we've kind of talked about the ESI protocol or production protocol, whatever you want to call it. It could be a discovery order. It could be a formal discovery agreement between the parties. It can kind of take on a couple of different titles, but it all kind of means the same thing. So, but let's talk about the technical aspects of production, like the mechanics. How does this thing work in the first place? So one of the first things that we want to understand is, hey, all the documents now that have been marked for production by our review teams, what are the format of these documents? Are we talking about producing a bunch of like Google documents, a bunch of emails? Are we going to be producing Word documents? Are these CAD drawings? Are they a bunch of, you know, engineering photos? Are they photos? Are they videos? Are they cell phone conversations? Are they extensive spreadsheets? Kind of
JSON data from right. like your Slack and your Teams.
Exactly. There's so many different data sources that we can be responsible for producing. That would be the one of the first things I would say, because that's going to really determine, number one, looking at our ESI protocol, how are we required to produce this? For example, if I have a CAD drawing, is there something in our protocol that says that I need to produce this in its native format? Because if I produce this as a PDF, the formatting might be so jacked up, I can't even see what the CAD drawing is. And that's really not producing the drawing. So maybe we have stipulated already that we're going to produce this in native format. So as you are considering the different format that you're required to produce the wide variety of data you may have, you have to make the determination, is this something I can do myself, or is this something that I need to outsource to a vendor? Because I don't have the capability to produce CAD drawings in the way that we've agreed to do that in this ESI protocol. So maybe that's my next step, is getting help with this production.
Yeah. And one thing I'll just say is it's super common for ESI protocols to spell out the file format of the produced data, especially when you're working with sources that have specific limitations. And that's simply because your data can and cannot do different things. For example, if you produce an Excel spreadsheet as an image, like as a PDF or as a TIFF, you won't be able to view the formulas that govern that spreadsheet. But you can if you produce it as a native file, or if you produce emails as images, you know, you might not be able to see the BCC line. And maybe that's important to you and maybe it isn't. Those are just a couple examples, but every data type has its capabilities and limitations, and you got to make sure to consider those.
And that being said, I think probably the most typical ways that data is produced is going to be either as a PDF, as a TIFF, or in its native format. So let's break those down a little bit. I'm going to start talking about PDFs. Why would somebody want to produce something as a PDF? Well, that's super easy because everybody can open up a PDF. That's something that's universally accessible by all. Also, if you have a PDF that can't be altered, then it's just that. You're preserving the way that that document or that email or whatever it is looked and felt without being edited on accident, of course. by anyone. So just the static nature of that PDF document. There are some cons to the PDF. One, which we've already talked about, which is the complex formatting. What happens when you have that crazy ass spreadsheet with a million different formulas and rows and the formatting's all jacked up when you try to make it as a PDF?
That's the legal term.
Yeah, that's the Brie legal term, just like Brie math.
That's technical legal terms.
There's Brie technical terms and legal terms and math. That's right. Well, then we also have the file size. What happens whenever you've got colored documentation that's like this huge manual, 1,000 pages, all in one PDF? That size is not going to be easily accessible once it's produced. And then we also have the issue of metadata being stripped out, which is a big one. We miss the original file name, perhaps, unless we're saving the PDF in that way. But we'll lose the date of modified, we lose the author, we lose all that helpful information that is likely required by the other party most of the time to be produced. So those are some pros and cons about PDFs. What about TIFFs, Angie?
Ooh, okay. So TIFFs. I feel like TIFFs are perhaps the most common production format a lot of the time, and that's because they have some pretty significant pros. TIFFs provide high-resolution images, which are great for ensuring that your document is clear and readable, especially if it's been scanned. That's a really big plus for them. They're also very stable. Like PDFs, you can't edit them. And because this has sort of become the standard, you know, they provide a really consistent format that's reliable for most legal reviews, meaning that you can pop a TIFF into a lot of different review platforms without an issue. Cons, though, like PDFs, you can end up with a large file size, which can make them a little bit more cumbersome to store or to transfer. But probably the biggest con is that, I don't even know if it's really a con, but one of the biggest things to consider is that you're gonna need a load file with your TIFFs. And we'll talk about load files in a couple minutes. Thing to note here, because TIFFs are image-based, they are not inherently text searchable unless you OCR them, which is optical character recognition. And that's where you just like run a program through them so that you can search. You can control F, basically. That's a very simplified explanation of OCR. So caveats abound. Applying OCR to your TIFFs can add another layer of complexity, as can producing a load file.
Well, and the fact that you even have to have a load file to be able to search that data means that you have to have a tool that will ingest that load file. So it's not something that someone without any discovery tool likely can do easily.
That said, like back to the pro of it being kind of universally used, most of your e-discovery tools are going to be able to take a load file, no problem.
And then the last one is native files. So the pros, you get all the metadata. Really easy to have any kind of native email document, whatever it is, contain that original metadata. It's still there. So you've got that. You've got full searchability because you've got all that searchable text on it. And so that's there automatically. You don't have to run OCR. You don't have to have a load file. And also most of your native files are going to be in common formats that are easy for you to access. And you've got Word, you've got Google, you've got Excel. So you're able to open most of those native files easily. But then we've got the cons. Angie can produce her native Word documents to me. And if I didn't like what they said, I might accidentally delete and replace what she had there.
Yeah, you're so shady, Brain.
I'm a shady girl. So that's a problem to have if you don't necessarily trust your opposing party. And then we have compatibility issues with the more unique file types. So just in the same way that we all have a way to access, you know, an email or a PDF or a Word doc, we don't all have a way maybe to access like a Visio file or a CAD drawing or some sort of proprietary tool that was used for whatever within an organization. So there's that part that's a little bit concerning in terms of native documents. In most productions today, there's going to be some sort of combo. We're going to produce everything in TIFF, but then maybe those complex documents like the CADs or like the huge spreadsheet, we're going to require that those are produced natively. We're kind of giving you guys pros and cons of doing one way or the other, but know that likely you're going to do a combination of a couple of these as part of your real production workflow.
Well, I feel extremely well informed and ready to perform a cost benefit analysis now.
Whoa.
But okay, I want to come back to metadata really quickly because we've touched on its importance a little bit, and I want to really drill down on some key points. So first is that metadata helps establish context and authenticity. When you get metadata for like an email and its attachments, they're going to contextualize those attachments, meaning they're going to link those attachments back to the parent email. So you're going to know when you load all this data into your review platform, you're going to be able to see that, hey, these attachments went with this email, as opposed to just getting an email and then some random documents and you don't know where they go. That context is really critical. It's also going to help you establish the authenticity of your documents. And authenticity is critical because in order to get evidence admitted in a court of law or at trial, you know, what have you, you have to establish that it's authentic, i.e., it is what it purports to be. Metadata is critical there because you can show that this document was created by the person who said they created it, was edited on the day that you say it was edited, as opposed to having it just be some like random document off the street. Another reason is metadata provides an audit trail for us so we can look back at the life cycle of a document, which can help prove or disprove tampering. You know, like Bree mentioned with some of these native file formats, I could get a Word document. If I don't like what it says, I can change it and be like, no, Bree gave this to me. But metadata will prove that I'm the one who edited it. Metadata will prove the condition of the document when I received it from Bree. And then finally, searching and filtering. We talk about this a lot with metadata, I guess, like being able to search and filter by fields. It is so, so, so powerful. And listeners, you can go back and listen to our review episode for a bigger discussion of metadata and searching and filtering. But for purposes of today's episode, let's just say it can help you filter your data set. You know, if you're producing only documents created before X date, you can filter by that metadata. If you're producing only documents by this author, you can filter by that metadata field. So it really just helps you wrangle these massive data sets and make sense of them in a much more efficient way.
You know, back in the day before we had electronic production, of course, we had boxes of documents that would get produced. So sometimes to be just a little bit evil, perhaps. And I'm not saying that I worked with people that did this.
Hypothetically
speaking, you would do like a dump on someone like, hey, you want us to produce all of our important crap? You know what? That's going to be a warehouse of documents. Yeah. And they're going to come to you. In fact, can we send them to your house? How about we send them to your front door? Good luck. You have to hire 100 people to go through those boxes, right? In the same vein, not producing metadata with a terabyte of documents is kind of like the same thing as dumping a truckload of boxes of documents for somebody to review page by page, because that's essentially what would have to happen. Angie, if your opposing party produced a terabyte of documents without data now, you're going to have to go OCR.
Like, fuck you.
Yeah, you're going to have to go OCR that so you can even search it, but you don't have any of that metadata to quickly determine who was the author, what date was this written, who was this sent to, and having to put all that together manually and recreate it is nearly impossible, but certainly would take so much time and money to have to recreate. So just kind of being devil's advocate in thinking about, number one, what did we agree to in the first place on our ESI protocol? But then number two, what are we doing to produce this data, and what metadata are we including in all of the fields and whatnot? Above and beyond what has been agreed on, you want to think about courtesy to the other party, or lack thereof. Maybe you don't want to be courteous to the other party. I don't know. I'm not going to tell you how to run your house, but I'm just going to tell you how it works.
But just know that if you want to, you can cloak your dickish behavior in under the guise of magnanimity and pretend like you're doing a nice thing for someone when really you're just giving them a middle finger.
Oh, man. I'm starting to see some of your little spitefulness come through, Angie.
Who, me? I'm just saying hypothetically you could do that.
Of course.
Well, and one other thing, what Bree was talking about, producing a truckload of data, maybe you're not doing that like just to be a jerk, but maybe you have to produce a document that's really bad for you. And so you want to bury it. You want to make the other side find a needle in a haystack, instead of making it easy for them to find this bad evidence for you. You're like, no, I gave it to you. It's just, it was one piece of paper in that whole box truck full of stuff. Hypothetically, you could do that too.
Well, we've been talking a lot about metadata, the do's and don'ts, the what it is, what people hypothetically may or may not do with it. But let's talk about when we don't want to produce something because there's some reason it needs to be redacted. Doom, doom, doom. What does redaction mean? Redaction is when we, and this is funny, actually, because one of the first things that ever happened to me as a paralegal, somebody told me to redact something and I had no idea what that word meant. And I was like, redact. Redact. How do we do that? And I asked the senior paralegal who had asked me to do this task. And she's like, well, you take white out and you just redact it. And I'm like, Oh, okay.
God.
So yeah, this was back in the day where you'd white out and then you put a sticker over the top that said redacted. Nowadays, when we're talking about redaction, we're talking about withholding some sort of content or field.
I'm picturing you sending this whiteout document to the other side along with like a quarter, and they just like scratch it off as if it's a lottery ticket.
No, Angie, because you would not send them the original. You can't send the original and have the stickers on it, because they won't do that. They would peel a sticker off. You'd have to get that imaged and copied. Anyway, going back to redaction. So redaction is when we need to remove data for whatever reason. And I'm saying, I'm giving privileged and confidential as a reason for redaction, but really it could also be for PII reasons. Maybe there's personal information. Angie has her social security number, her credit card number, her address, things like that we don't want to produce to the other party. We could also be redacting because it's part of a DSAR request or a privacy request. A customer or client has said, I need for you to find everywhere that has my name and my information on it. And I want it completely redacted. I want all of my data masked is another request that will happen as a result of a GDPR request. So whether we're masking data, redacting it, what have you, it's typically done with some sort of tool. Now, if you're going super old school and you don't have any discovery tool, it'd also be using like Photoshop, or you could be using Adobe Pro or something like that. Likely, though, if you are handling larger productions, you'll have an e-discovery tool that would help you create redactions, which means you could apply redactions within the tool and you would be able to temporarily preserve them while you're reviewing data so that you could hover over your redaction and see what's being redacted, making triple checking sure that that's actually what you want to redact. But then once we get to the production phase, we're actually going to burn that redaction, which I don't know. I think burning, that term burning comes from the olden days, but it's still being used. We'll burn that makes redaction sense. Onto your image, which means we'll permanently put a black mark or a white mark or purple mark, whatever color you want that mark to be, on your document and in lieu of that text. Kind of depending on what tools you have at your disposal will depend on how you get the redaction done. A word of advice, I will say, is to remember if you are producing documents in a TIFF format, remember it's not just the TIFF image itself that needs to have that redaction burned on it. You also need to redact the metadata off that load file that gets produced with that TIFF image. That is a quality control step that usually, well, if you hire a service provider to do that, that's part of their quality control process. But if you're doing that internally, you want to make sure you go back and look at your load file and double check all those redactions that you burned onto the image. Hopefully all of those words are also redacted out of that load file. Otherwise, you produced all that stuff and you're going to have to claw that shit back. And we will talk about that in a moment.
Yes, we will.
Okay, so that's an important step in our document production, is making sure that we redact what we do not want to produce for whatever reason. We need to determine when we are making those redactions, how they kind of classify in terms of their confidentiality. And a lot of times this will go back to dun, 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 your ESI protocol and how you've decided to handle privilege and confidentiality. And it will also correlate with your privilege log. So when we're producing documents and we're having to redact them or just completely withhold them because they are privileged and confidential, or for whatever reason, we've agreed to withhold them, we need to make sure that we're logging them on a privilege log. Hey, this document, such and such, was withheld for this reason of confidentiality or privilege. And then we want to make sure we adhere to the format that we agreed to communicate that in terms of the document production itself. So a lot of times what will happen if you have to completely remove a document that's responsive to privilege, you might insert a slip sheet instead, just saying, hey, this represents a document that it's being withheld. I've described it on the privilege log. This is the reason why it's being withheld, but here's our way of documenting that, but you ain't getting it, sucka. So think again. So
go pound sand.
That's right. An effective way that we can refer to our document production, by the way, which has been done for many, 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 many years, is Bates numbering. Bates numbering is a way that we identify each individual document and or page of a document with its own unique numbering system or sometimes labeling system that can be referred to like in a deposition or in trial or in a hearing or in legal correspondence. You know, please refer to Bates number document XYZ PDQ attached here too. And that consistent labeling or numbering, each party will have the reference to the same document. Usually what will happen is a Bates number will have a prefix, like sometimes the company who's producing it or the party who's producing it, followed by a number. It might be, I don't know, PTF 00001 or DEF 00001 for defendant. or company ABC might be ABC0001. You can decide however you'd like to produce your documents, and sometimes that's even prescribed to you in that ESI protocol. Anyhow, I'm not going to get super granular on Bates numbering, but when we do produce, we want to make sure that we have Bates numbers that are burned or branded, are the words that we use, to that image so that they can be properly identified. And we want that Bates number to typically be a field in our load file so that when we load that document production to our system, then there will be a field for the Bates number and they can be sorted that way. Also, another branding that may happen is confidentiality or privilege marking. So that's often a step that we go through when we produce documents, is to determine, hey, do we want the Bates labels on the lower right-hand side, on the lower left-hand side, the upper corner? And then where do we want that confidentiality marking to be? And of course, we want to make sure that we are keeping true to that Bates numbering as we might roll on to production number two in the same matter, meaning, hey, we're in this large litigation, and as phase one, we have produced to you Bates number documents 1 through 50,000 million. Now, now we have done some additional review. We've gone through another set of depositions or discovery or what have you. And now we're going to roll into another production. That's going to start with Bates number 50,000,001,001. I don't know, Angie, maybe you could speak more to a rolling production.
Yeah. Well, and I want to add one quick thing about Bates numbering and why it's important. And that's because when you get into depositions and trial and stuff, you're creating an audio record, which, you know, or a written record of what happens during those proceedings. And so if you show a witness a document, you will typically identify that as the lawyer presenting that exhibit to the witness. You'll typically identify it by Bates number for the record, so that future, if anyone's looking at this transcript in the future, they know exactly what document you were talking about down to the page. So it helps you create a really clear record. And then one thing I want to flag about confidentiality steps is there are a couple different levels of confidentiality. There's just like guard variety confidential, there's highly confidential, and there's attorney's eyes only. And you might not use all of those in a given production, or you might. It just depends on your data set. But like confidential could refer to, you know, a business's proprietary information, for example. An attorney's eyes only could be information that is not public, ultra critical to a business's core operations. It's going to vary case by case, but I did just want to flag that there are different confidentiality designations that are available, and you can pick which ones work for you in that case. The question you actually asked me, Brie. So rolling productions. So this is fun. There are two different ways to produce documents. You could do a rolling production, or you could do a non-rolling production. A rolling production is one where you do it sort of in phases or stages. So maybe you produce Bates numbers 0 through 500,000 in your document set number one. And then every so often, maybe every month or whatever your production schedule is, you produce a set number of documents. One reason you might want to do a rolling production versus a non-rolling production is if you've got a really large data set. So you want to produce it sort of in batches as you review it, because otherwise it's just going to become unwieldy and it's going to take you forever to get the data over to the other side. Another reason you might want to use a rolling production is like maybe you're on a big time crunch to get stuff to the other side. Maybe you really need to kick production off right away, and so you want to do it in a rolling fashion. A non-rolling production is, like I said, you know, you just do one production at once. And it can be helpful because you could get a comprehensive view of your data before producing, whereas a rolling production, you know, you could still be in the middle of reviewing as you're producing documents. So depending on the size of your case and the subject matter, you might want to do a complete review before you produce anything, or you might not. Kind of a main downside of doing a non-rolling production is you have to wait till you're done reviewing. And so that can cause delays, and that can be problematic for your case schedule. It can be problematic for, you know, your company's operations or what have you. So basically, there are pros and cons to both, like anything, and you're going to have to pick the solution that fits the needs of your case.
In my experience, I think that if you're in litigation, you're going to have somewhat of a rolling production, because it seems like there's always stuff that comes up, you know, as you're going through those depositions, as you're going to hearings, as you're having back and forth conversation with your clients, with opposing counsel, there's going to be additional stuff that you got to produce. So keeping record of your document production, where what's included, what format you did it in, what Bates label you stopped at, et cetera, is all really important in trying to keep yourself organized. Carrying on our conversation about production, one important thing that we have talked about a lot as we have discussed metadata is a load file. So I'm going to go into that in a little bit of greater detail, because it's one of those things that unless you deal with production often, you probably don't know very much about it, and you might not want to know much about it. We're going to force feed you. If you ever open up a load file, which oftentimes is in a format that's not normal for your working, like, I don't know, maybe it's a DAT file format would be a format that's often used. What that looks like when you open it up is a bunch of gobbledygook. I always like to compare a load file to a roadmap, because essentially when you are ingesting a document production into an e-discovery tool, you are ingesting images and you are ingesting metadata that's being populated within the fields of that application. And a load file is like the map that points you in the directions that you need to go so that you can properly link the image with the metadata that it corresponds to, and that the metadata will be properly filled in the right fields. Your load file is going to have different delimiters that it will use to divide up the different meta fields. A lot of times those delimiters are things like the pipe or a comma or a semicolon, depending on the type of load file that you have. And so you might see something like Angie, pipe, January 1st, 2004, pipe, Brie, pipe, privilege and confidential. All of the pipes are dividing up different fields that are going to be fed into your e-discovery tool to tell you that Angie is the author of this document that was dated on that date, and maybe Brie was the recipient, and it was also marked privilege in that example anyway. So that's what a load file is essentially doing in terms of its purpose. Things that you want to make sure that your load file will contain are, number one, all the fields you agreed to whenever you agreed to your ESI protocol, all the fields that are required by your judge or your court that must be produced, or all the fields that are required by that regulating body. Like maybe you have the DOJ, they have their own standards format that they need to have that metadata. The other thing that you want to make sure is that your load file doesn't include anything that you're not supposed to be producing. Like we were talking earlier, you don't want to have that redacted text in there. You also don't want to produce too much. And maybe this is just spiteful Brie, but I don't want to give more than I am required to give, right? Because maybe it's helpful. I don't want to help the other side manipulate my data in an efficient way. So I certainly don't want to give things I'm not supposed to give. You're going to also want to make sure that your load file keeps consistent across rolling production. So like Angie was saying before, we might have different stages to our document production. I'm producing a boatload of documents now, but since this is such a huge amount of data, I have a review team of 100 people, and we can only churn out so many documents in a month's time. And every month, we'll just produce to you a new set of documents. So every time that we produce it, we're going to make sure the metadata within that load file is consistent with the load file that we produced before. That's really important, not just to keep you organized, but just to also cut down on errors and ingesting that data on the flip side, the receiving party. You also want to make sure that you have quality control on your load files. Do not just trust that your e-discovery tool, whatever it is producing a load file the way that you think it is without looking at it. You want to go in there and just kind of do a test. Where's a document that I marked as confidential or that I've redacted, I want to make sure that that text is actually not in there. I want to go through and double check to make sure that all of my different fields are actually listed in that load file. Sometimes I think people are scared of a load file because it looks so wonky when you open it up, but it could really be the keys to accidentally producing something that you didn't mean to, or accidentally not complying with protocol. When somebody receives a load file and they are ingesting it into their tool for review, they have to do something that we call data mapping, or mapping the fields. So if Angie produces a load file that gives me 10 fields, you know, author, recipient, date, file path, whatever, then I want to make sure when I'm ingesting that data into my tool that I've properly mapped it to the fields that my tool calls that. Maybe she's using the field called originated date, and I have date created in my database. So I need to make sure that when I'm ingesting that load file that I've properly mapped it so that the system will know, oh, when I see her field, I'll know that I actually need to populate what it really means, what it's mapped to in this application. And I know that we talked about some of these steps in terms of load files and keeping consistent for rolling productions, but really it also can help you with quality control. What are some best practices, Angie, that you can share about quality control?
Yeah. So one of the big ones is just a data completeness check. And that sounds pretty simple, but it's basically just ensuring that the data that was supposed to be produced has been included. The fields that were supposed to be produced have been included. You don't want any gaps. And this can be done, you know, using tools that compare a data set against your production specs to catch any missing pieces. And then another one is just format accuracy. So you just want to make sure, you want to have somebody just go through and check that the format that you've agreed to produce data is the format that you're producing that data in. So you want to make sure that your Excel spreadsheets are being produced as native files. They're not being produced as PDFs or TIFFs. You want to make sure that maybe your emails are being produced as TIFFs. And so you just want to go through and make sure that all of that is tightened up. Another really good way, and this sounds so informal, but it's such a standard practice, is just doing a spot check. Check one out of every 20, 50, 100 docs, you know, typically you want to hit like 10%-ish, give or take, of your production that you want to be spot checking just to make sure that your data is thorough, it's complete, it doesn't look wonky, you know, your TIFFs aren't cutting anything out of the margins, that your stamps, your Bates numbers, your confidentiality stamps, your redactions, they've all been applied properly. You want to go through and just spot check it. And all of these things are going to help you prevent bigger issues with your production. You're going to catch those problems before you produce things and all of a sudden are in a situation where you try to claw them back. It'll also help you save time and money. You know, if you catch things early, it's going to hopefully help you avoid a situation where you're having to reproduce data or go back and like fix your errors. And then finally, you know, it just helps you maintain the integrity of your production. And that can have more far-reaching consequences than you might think. Like, first of all, it's going to help your position in that individual matter, whether it's a lawsuit or your relationship with a government entity, what have you. But you also want to have a reputation for being an organization that produces data with integrity. And you want that because you don't want to be the entity that keeps winding up in court arguing about production issues. You don't want to be the entity that your government regulators don't trust because your productions are always shoddy or you're always hiding something. You know, you don't want to be the entity that people know that they're going to have to get into extensive motions practice with because that's really expensive. So you do want to make sure that you've got a good quality control procedure and that you're using that. One last thing I'll say, and not to just be too much of a lawyer about this, but just document it. Write down your QC procedure. Have an audit trail for your QC procedure because that's going to help you in so many ways down the line too.
In terms of production in general, and certainly this goes for QC procedure, but the more you can stay organized, the more you will thank yourself later on, and just keeping consistency, knowing that every single time I do a document production, this is the QC steps that I follow. This is the way that I log it internally so I can go back and find what I was working on or for whatever reasons. You'll really thank yourself in the end.
Absolutely.
Okay, Angie. So I feel like we've really done a great job talking about, you pretty much did a great job talking about quality control and, you know, how we can make sure that we have the highest integrity and the most accurate document production going out. But what happens when we have an accident? Oopsies. Ooh. and we accidentally missed that privilege document, or we accidentally produced all of that privilege metadata, what are our options then? Because it feels like doom and gloom, and like you want to throw up and have diarrhea all at the same time when you realize that this has happened.
Yeah. So first of all, terminology. So you're going to hear them called clawbacks. You're going to hear them called 502Ds. And for purposes of today's episode, we're not going to get into the difference between those things, but this is what we're talking about. We're talking about how you deal with an oopsie. You produce privileged information. You know, you forget to burn your confidentiality stamps on. Something goes awry and you're going to have an agreement with the other side. These are super common. You know, you're going to have them pretty much in every case, but you've got an agreement that you've got a period of time where you can say, I need a mulligan. Give me my data back. And the agreement or your order will typically say something like, the party has X number of days, let's say 30 days as an example. You've got 30 days post-production to identify any issues and execute your clawback. And what that means is, as the producing party, you can go to the party or the entity that you produce data to and be like, hey, I didn't mean to produce this. Please give it back to me. And Bree and I talked about this a little bit earlier. Like, you can't really unring the bell. You know, you produce your smoking gun to the other side on accident and they see it and then they know it's out there. And they might not be able to use that specific document, but now they know that information that they weren't supposed to have. While clawbacks are great for preventing that evidence at getting in at trial or getting in front of a judge, you can't fully unring the bell.
Yeah.
But you also don't want that data to sit out there forever.
That brings us to some tips and tricks that I guess we could share, Angie, to keep us from ever getting to the place where we have to have a clawback.
Yeah. So first and foremost is have a QC. Do your QC. Do it, do it, do it. Do not skip it. Do not skimp. It's so, so, so important.
Yeah. And I would say, I would add on to that. If you are a company that does not have the man or woman power to handle a larger document production and you find yourself needing a larger document production, do not be afraid to ask for help. Our service providers that are out there have such great, well, I would say reputable service providers that are out there have such great practices for how they run a document production. You can ask when you're hiring a service provider, what is your QC process? I want to see some of that documentation. I want to understand what that looks like so that you know who's looking at your documents before they go out the door, so you don't have any of those terrible instances of producing things that you didn't intend to. It's worth it to spend the money to have outside help at this point if you're not able to do that in-house.
Don't be penny wise and pound foolish, because often if you're not experienced in productions, that's exactly what it ends up being. Right? You tried to DIY and then you end up creating a bigger mess that costs more to unravel.
So I would also say, you know, tips and tricks, a lot of that boils back down to that ESI protocol. You want to make sure that you've thought about everything and that you've specifically called it out, but you also want to be smart about what you've agreed to do so that you know that you can actually comply with what you said that you can comply with. I think that those are some tips or tricks. I don't know how genius that might be, but that will keep you out of a lot of hot water.
That's our tips and tricks, folks. Don't be dumb.
That's right.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of our show. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a 5-star review and tell your friends, family, and coworkers about us. And of course, please hit us up on LinkedIn or at admin@ediscoverychicks.com with your thoughts, questions, and drink recommendations. Until next time.
Bye.
Bye.